Hello everybody and welcome to this video, which is kindly sponsored by Squarespace. And today we're really going to stress test poor old Squarespace. You're going to see first we're going to go to the archive and I'm going to add a new section called General RN Photos because I've managed to digitize over 1,000 photos all in one go and I'm going to upload about half of them now. So I'm just creating a URL which is referencing an internal gallery page I've created. There's the gallery page, standard default page, quickly remove all the stock photos and then go to upload. And well, here's the initial images, but as you can see, I can go into edit section, first make it a full bleed. Then I'm going to change it to 4 pictures per column. And then I'm going to change the aspect ratio because these are all photos that have been put on A4 pages. And as you can see, that means you can see exactly which ship and which class each ship is in. And it took the website all of about 4 or 5 minutes to process the 500 or so photos that I just uploaded, or scans, I should say. And once it is uploaded, there's no real lag or anything when it comes to formatting these things. And as I scroll through them, as you can see, I can just open in full resolution, and you can do that too, and zoom in as much as you like. And having gone in with a bit of trepidation, I can report that the upload and display procedure was actually faster than many dedicated photo websites. So if after all these little mini tutorials I've been doing, you think you could build a website for maybe ideally naval history purposes, but you never know, you might want to do it for some other reason, then head over to squarespace.com/Drakenefell. You can get a free trial, and once you're ready, that little link will give you 10% off your first website or domain. So thanks once again to Squarespace for sponsoring the video, and on with the main show. Hello, everybody. Now, you might be thinking, well, this is a bit of a unique Q&A, and yes, to a certain extent it is. It's essentially come about because, obviously, at this point of release a few weeks ago, I published a video about Bismarck, her wreck, the wreck damage, etc. Most of you have probably seen that. And that, understandably, triggered quite a lot of questions in the pinned post for Q&A, etc. But I realised very quickly that quite a number of you had some very specific questions about the wreck damage. But there were enough of those that even if when eventually the dry dock segment that comes to that week's videos only focused on specific wreck damage questions, we still wouldn't answer anywhere close to all of them. And then there's all the other questions that are in there as well. So I thought I'm going to take most, if not all, of the wreck damage based questions that I could find on the video and turn them into their own separate little Q&A, which is what you're going to be listening to now, hopefully. And then when the regular dry docks catch up with that week's worth of videos, then I can more generally select from the questions that have been asked, or if there are any wreck specific questions that have been asked since this video going live, then obviously we can talk about those as well. Anyway, that's why we've got this special edition Q&A, and let's get on with the questions. Imprisoned Grover Fur asks, how did Bismarck's torpedo defense system perform in action compared to those of its contemporary battleship designs? Was it average, better than average, or poorer than average? Unfortunately, it's not actually possible to say, despite what some people on the internet would have you believe. And that's simply because you have to divide the hits that Bismarck took into, well, 3 or 4 separate categories. So you can imagine it as maybe a 2x2 grid. So along one axis is the location of the hit. Was it a hit that was actually covered by the torpedo defense system, or a hit that wasn't covered by the torpedo defense system? So for example, the famous hit that takes out Bismarck's rudder, and from the look of the wreck, also the central prop. Well, that is obviously an area outside of the torpedo defense system. So the fact that it does quite catastrophic damage to the ship doesn't really reflect in any way, shape, or form on her torpedo defense system because, well, there it just wasn't in that area. So that's one axis of your grid. And the other axis is, what was the torpedo that actually hit the ship? Was it a lightweight-airborne torpedo? Or was it a heavyweight-shipborne torpedo? Because, of course, she wasn't hit by many submarine-launched torpedoes. And that's simply because, well, the airborne torpedoes were 18-inch torpedoes. They had a smaller warhead than the 21-inch torpedoes launched by various Royal Navy cruisers, or indeed the 24.5-inch torpedoes launched by Rodney. So when you're looking at the 18-inch air-dropped torpedoes from the Swordfish, And you compare that to the design specifications of Bismarck's torpedo defence system, and you find that the average warhead weight of a standard British airdrop torpedo in the first half of the Second World War was about 200 kilos, and Bismarck's torpedo defences were designed to absorb a 250-kilo warhead, with some reports indicating that shore testing pointed out that perhaps in some areas that system was perhaps a little bit more capable than its design spec, obviously where it was thickest. So if an airdrop torpedo hits Bismarck's main torpedo defence, which indeed some of them did during the various aerial attacks, you would expect that torpedo defence system to be able to withstand said attack. So the fact that it did isn't, as some online commentators would have you believe, evidence that Bismarck was some kind of super durable ship. It's just evidence that the systems that were built into it were working as intended. And it's not exactly like it was a particularly highly rated torpedo defence system. The Littorios, the South Dakotas, the Iowas, and the King George V, among others, all had torpedo defence systems that were rated against either larger or significantly larger torpedo warheads. So that leaves only really one box in our 2x2 grid where we would expect to find a torpedo actually potentially breaching the defences, and if it didn't, then that would be a significant mark in favour of Bismarck. And that would be the torpedoes from the British cruisers and from Rodney in the final engagement, because they all carry torpedoes with warheads significantly in excess of 250 kilos, and if those hit Bismarck's torpedo defences, you would expect them to breach the torpedo defences, and if they didn't, then at that point we would be looking at saying, oh yeah, Bismarck's torpedo defence system performed significantly better than anyone really expected it to, and competitive with some of the other ships I just mentioned previously. But unfortunately, the state of the wreck as it is means that we are, I wouldn't say never, but very unlikely to ever be able to discern anything specific about those torpedo hits, simply because Bismarck rests roughly, not entirely, but roughly speaking, in the mud at the approximate waterline. She's a little bit heavier down at the bow and a little bit lighter aft, but not by a huge amount. But essentially what this means is that any torpedo strikes that hit at their intended depths, which would have been, you know, 15, 20, 25 foot down from the waterline, are at the very best concealed by several, possibly several dozen feet of mud. And more likely, that evidence has been either partially or totally obliterated, because it seems very likely that basically everything that's more than a few feet below the mud line, as you've seen on the wreck at the moment, has either been compacted down into a thin sandwich, in which point it's going to be almost impossible to pick torpedo damage out from all the other damage, even if you put a dredger down there. Or the other possibility is that most of the underlying section of the ship below the waterline has just been torn off and is scattered in various bits of the debris field, like that bit of the bow is. Although, having said that, if a significant portion of the Bismarck's lower hull further back was torn off in a big chunk, well, if that did happen and we were then able to find it, it might actually be substantially more intact than if that section of the lower hull remained attached to the ship, whereas at that point it's probably been pancaked into an unrecognisable mess. One thing that we can prove about torpedoes and Bismarck, though, from the wreck, is that the suggestions that you sometimes see in various internet accusations or allegations, and also in some earlier books, that torpedoes from Dorsetshire hit quite high up on the ship, and some people even say in the superstructure, while the ship was already on its way down, are complete nonsense, because we do have the above water section of the ship and none of it shows evidence of, you know, 350 plus kilos of explosive going off, which is what would have happened if a torpedo had hit it. Donald Irons asks, in the James Cameron documentary on Bismarck, it showed damage, specifically a hole, in the hull above the central shaft. Was this filmed by the Magellan ROV, and if so, what are your thoughts on its effects on the crew's damage control efforts? Yes, that hole is there. You can actually see it, as you can see on screen and in the video footage. It's just that the particular angle, you kind of have to be looking up, and at the point that I showed you that bit of footage, I was kind of directing your attention to the propeller, so you can understand if that was missed, perhaps, in general observations. Nonetheless, yeah, it is there. What are my thoughts on its effects on the crew's damage control efforts? Well, obviously, it's not going to help. Even in the photos of Bismarck after Denmark Strait, when it's quite clear her bow is quite severely down and her stern is slightly up, this area still would have been underwater, and therefore, obviously, that breach in watertight integrity would mean the area above the rudders was very heavily flooded, which is indeed what is reported by the survivors. So, essentially, having open access to the sea is not only obviously going to damage equipment in the stern more, but it's also going to mean that even in the areas that aren't directly flooded, there's going to be leaks and so forth, which is going to absorb damage control crew efforts time, and the leaking water is going to complicate things still further. So, yeah, it's definitely going to have hindered the damage control crew's efforts to try and fix the rudders, if indeed it was even possible to fix them at all. It would also cause a small bit of additional drag to the ship, which would slow its top speed down somewhat, but that's rather incidental to everything else. Morningstar 1138 asks, was there any particular piece of damage you've seen on the wreck that either shocked you or surprised you, and what was it and why? I would say yes. I think there were two bits of damage that ticked that category. One was a relatively minor bit of damage in the grand scheme of things, but it did serve to rather brutally illustrate just what kind of energy you're looking at, because there's a lot of shell impacts, there's a lot of shell holes, etc. And you're kind of used to the idea, certainly if you're a naval historian, this is what shells do to ships. That it's not pretty, it's not nice, but it follows a fairly regular pattern. But when you look at the first 105mm mount, the one that's basically had its entire left-hand side just ripped off and dragged backwards into the superstructure by an incoming shell that's then freight-trained its way through the deck and the hull behind it to explode inside the ship, I would say that would be the lesser of the two that kind of shocked me, not because of any particular dramaticness about it, but simply because, as I said, everywhere else you see the path of a shell ending in an explosion relatively clearly, or penetration that would go on to either cause or be part of an explosion. Whereas this is a distinct part of the ship that has just literally been bodily lifted up and ripped off of the rest of it, i.e. the rest of the gun mount, and just carried away as a bunch of wreckage and then slammed straight on through the rest of the ship. And it's just a very brutal thing to have happened. And yes, admittedly, having the entire back of a secondary turret blown out is also a fairly brutal thing to have happened. But as I said, that is kind of contiguous with the shell exploded, therefore this happened. And I suppose it's somewhat easier to accept that big shell explode, lot of damage happens, as opposed to you see something like that and you realize that's just pure brutal kinetic energy, as I said, just steam draining its way straight through something before going on to do even more damage elsewhere. But the single biggest bit of wreckage and biggest bit of damage that I would say either shocked or surprised me, I think so far has to be Turret Bruno. Now, obviously, as you will know from my Reinabung documentary, we already knew that Bruno had suffered some pretty brutal damage, including the back armor plate being blown out. However, the first time I saw the footage of Bruno turret, I was looking at it, and it took, as I said in the video that these questions are from, it took me a while to actually appreciate what it was I was looking at. And the same thing for the other observers, because it is such a mangled mess. And you know, we've got the other turrets, and at some point in the future on Magellan's channel, you'll see at least two more of them, as well as more detailed footage from Bruno and some other damage that's on Bruno, or the remains of Bruno turret that I didn't point out in this particular video. But when you compare those to what's left of poor old Bruno turret,
the fact that it's so mangled that it took a while to realize this is actually what's left of a turret says volumes about the amount of destruction that's been wreaked on it. And then when you realized what the damage was that was causing the visual identification issues, and you realize, wow, that's the entire essentially back deck of the turret, just completely twisted, in many cases near enough 90 degrees. Then you suddenly realize, okay, what we thought of before was a fairly brutal event. This is even more brutal than even I had imagined, because at that point, bearing in mind, obviously, the floor is going to have somewhat less mass and therefore be somewhat more vulnerable than the back plate of the turret. Given that the back plate of the turret was blown out and sent flying, the fact that this floor plate bent down meant you'd almost have had a fairly major rocket-like effect from the explosion before the back plate gave out, lifting the back of the turret up, which would explain some depictions and descriptions which actually describe Bruno turret as canted down forward slightly, because it may well have been at least partially bodily lifted out of the barbette before being dumped down as the explosion dies down. It's just an absolutely horrific level of destruction. David Letter asks, is Bismarck sinking into the mud? Will we eventually lose access to the wreck entirely? No, it's not. As I pointed out in the video a few times, and again on the Magellan's channel, as we look through the more extensive wreck footage, it's very, very clear and becoming still clearer that Bismarck, as we know, hit the side of an underwater mountain, but it's becoming very evident that that seabed mud coating of the mountainside really is not that thick. In some places it's a few feet, in other places it's approaching a dozen feet or thereabouts, plus or minus a little bit, but there is basically zero chance of Bismarck sinking into that mud, because directly below that relatively thin mud layer is just the solid rock of the mountainside, and that's pretty much what the wreck is resting on at this point. And it's not going to, Bismarck was not designed by Bethesda. It may be inefficient, but it's not going to no-clip through the rock. It's just going to be there. Obviously, there is a slight settling of marine snow on her, which in theory over thousands upon thousands of years could build up to render her kind of like almost like an Anglo-Saxon barrow burial, with just a little mound on the seabed. But the current is such as it is there, is removing some of that, almost as fast as it deposits. So that's relatively unlikely to cut off our access to the wreck. If anything is ever going to cut off access to the wreck, it may be a build-up of the marine sediment somewhat higher up on the mountainside, and then at some point some kind of underwater tremor causing an underwater landslide. And if that happens, then obviously underwater mud and whatever else the seabed is made up of might cascade over some or all of the wreck site. But that's a very, very specific set of circumstances. You'd have to have a build-up of mud and marine snow higher up the mountainside above the wreck site, and it be triggered to collapse down specifically towards the wreck, which may well happen at some point in the future, but it's not kind of something that I'd be particularly worried about happening anytime soon. Awkward Doggo asks, how was the underwater portion of Bismarck just ripped off? I didn't know that before. Well, looking at the forward part of the underwater portion of the ship's wreck, the bit that was underwater while the ship was on the surface, obviously the whole thing's underwater now, but nonetheless, it appears to be, at least with that portion, that the ship almost certainly hit the underwater mountain stern first and then slammed down into the seabed. And from what I can tell looking at that, what then seems to have happened is obviously a shockwave, as well as a very severe bending moment, has travelled along the ship from the stern. And as the ship has slammed down, obviously there's been a whole bunch of hydraulic blowout as well. So as that wave of damage has rippled along the vessel from stern to bow, it's eventually reached a section of the ship where the ship is relatively narrow, obviously, the bow section, and the shockwave would have been the first thing to travel through because that's traveling through the solid members of the ship. And the ship has then started to fail, or at least be severely weakened, along the weakest portion of this thin portion of the ship, which obviously being the bow is the bit that is closest to the waterline, because that's the thinnest portion of an already overall thin portion of the ship. And so with a failure kind of starting there, and then compounded by the bending and the initial resistance from the seabed and the rocks underneath it, all of that seems to have just conspired to cause a rather sudden failure horizontally. And then as you get further and further back to a point where the ship is wide enough that that failure is no longer contiguous across the hull, it's being supported by perhaps some internal sections, etc. That's when it appears that, you know, brute force has come into play, and up the bow, or the lower portion of the bow, and the rest of the ship have kind of come into not opposite alignments, but they've been kind of going in opposite directions. And obviously the lower portion, which is dragged off to one side, has just been torn off at that point, which is why the back end of that lower portion of the bow is very, very much torn up, as opposed to along that horizontal break, which is pretty clean. And as I mentioned before, what exact implications that has for the rest of the underwater sections of the ship further back, who knows? More examination of the debris field is needed, but it's possible that some portions of the underside of the ship beyond that section of the bow may well have also been ripped off at some stage. Edsel Rodriguez asks, regarding the widespread observation about the weakness of the thin sterns of German ships, I would ask a few simple questions. When did the stern break off? Did it break off during the Battle of May 27th? Did it break off during the brief descent that took the ship to the depth of 4,000 metres? And is it necessary to build a stern strong enough to prevent it from breaking off after sinking and hitting the seabed? How many ships retain that structural integrity after 85 years and withstanding so many hits? By all accounts, Bismarck's stern was still attached when she went under, so it didn't break off during battle. Whether it broke off immediately as the ship began to descend, during the descent, or when it hit the seabed, it's pretty much impossible to say. As you saw from the wreck footage, it was a pretty clean break, which to me would suggest a rather sudden collapse, which would to me say that it either happened right at the start of the sinking, when there would have been very unusual differential loads on it as part of the ship went underwater and other bits didn't, or with the sudden impact of the ship hitting the seabed. If it had broken off mid-fall, substantially mid-fall, that is, I would expect a little bit more tearing and a less of a clean break. Now, is it necessary to build a stern that's strong enough to prevent it from breaking off after sinking and hitting the seabed? Well, if the ship has sunk, you don't really care whether the stern stays on at that point or not. But as I mentioned in the video before, the original video, this was a known weakness of German ships. Several large German ships that suffered hits towards the stern suffered either partial or complete stern collapses. So this is a weakness to the design. It's not just something that happened to happen because of the sheer amount of damage that the ship took. As far as how many ships retain their stern structural integrity after 85 years and withstanding so many hits, actually quite a few. This is one of the reasons why it's known as a weakness of German ship design. So, for example, HMS Prince of Wales, at least before she was horrifically illegally salvaged in more recent times, when her wreck was discovered, she, of course, also took a rather major torpedo hit to the stern. And when she sank, she actually rolled over, so she hit the seabed upside down, whereas Bismarck hit the seabed the right way up, and her stern stayed attached. Kirishima was pelted by quite a lot of shells from Washington, including a number of confirmed 16-inch shell hits again to the stern, and she also came to rest upside down, therefore obviously being subjected to a bit more force that she wasn't designed for than Bismarck, and her stern also remained attached. I could go on, but yeah, you kind of get the idea. Ships that sank actually, generally speaking, still have their sterns attached in most cases. I mean, even Hood, which was quite literally blown in two by an aft magazine explosion, didn't suffer a stern collapse. The bit of the stern that, you know, wasn't blown apart by the magazine explosion is still there and didn't have its end fall off. And Yamato, which admittedly didn't have an aft magazine explosion, but was blown in half by a magazine explosion, albeit the forward one, as well as suffering perhaps secondary explosions aft, and had the aft portion of its hull land upside down, again subjecting it to quite a lot of stress, also didn't have its stern collapse and fall off. And Jeffrey Blake has multiple questions. In fact, he titles his comment, "I have many questions about this," so I'm just going to go through the questions quickfire style in the order that he posted them. So one, he says, "Are you attributing the Barbette penetration to Bruno's explosion? Because from my understanding, Duran said that the starboard gunhouse towards the rear of the overhang was penetrated. He also stated that he thinks an internal detonation inside the gunhouse pushed the overhang floor downward, as clearly seen in your video, and that the back armor plate, now unsupported, simply fell off." And so, sort of yes and no. I'm not attributing the Barbette penetration to Bruno's explosion. I was simply pointing out that that was a rather destructive penetration of Bruno as a turret system. And in actual fact, when we get round to looking at the Bruno turret wreckage in a lot more detail on Magellan's channel, we'll actually be able to match up, I think, that Barbette penetration with damage to the section of the turret that's still visible above the mud line. So I don't think that particular hit was what was responsible. According to the accounts of Rodney's gunners and some of the survivors of Bismarck, the shell that did the job penetrated the front face of the turret. So I would somewhat disagree that the gunhouse toward the rear over the overhang was penetrated, simply because, well, that's not what the accounts of the people who actually tracked that shell in say. Obviously, there's the internal detonation, which obviously everybody agrees on that happened. But saying that the back armor plate, now unsupported, simply fell off, again, from accounts from both sides, they talk about that armor plate being blown off rather than simply falling off, which obviously, you know, that survivor's accounts versus a later historical analysis, you could take it either way. However, from the footage that the ROV recovered that shows the side of the deck that would have been opposite from the way that Bruno was facing at that point, i.e. where this massive piece of armor plate would have hit if it had just fallen off, there doesn't appear to be any kind of significant dent or gouging, which is what you would expect if you dropped several hundred tons of armor plate straight down onto a wooden deck with a little bit of metal plating underneath. Yeah, you know, there's no sign of that big slab of metal just guillotining down. So it would suggest to me that if it did fall, as opposed to being blown off, then it at least, quote-unquote, fell backwards with a reasonable amount of energy such that it was rotated. And if it did land, if it landed flat, that may not have left enough damage to then be seen by the ROV. But as I said, that would require still enough energy for it to be thrown somewhat backwards and rotated, as opposed to just falling. Because if it fell, it would just, you know, fall like a guillotine blade, and then there would be fairly substantial damage to the deck. But the absence of any significant visible damage to that portion of the deck makes me more inclined to believe the idea that it was blown off at least a reasonable distance backward and then probably just fell off the ship, or was blown over the side in the first place. He then goes on to ask, did the video allow you to figure out what hit caused Turret Anton and Bruno to cease fire initially at some point between 0902 and 0905, as this hit is still one of the biggest questions unanswered? I wouldn't say definitively, because of course both Anton and Bruno turrets then parted company with the rest of the ship, and that big hole in Bruno's barbette is the only thing that's remained on the ship that is fairly significant evidence of major damage. I mean, obviously there's other bits of damage around it, but in terms of the knocking out the two turrets, that's probably the first big clue. So while I obviously can't definitively prove it one way or the other, I would say the three top competing candidates in my mind would be either the hit around that point that wipes out the command crew and damages the forward fire control rangefinder station, possibly could be a cause in that, well, the turrets would lose access to fire control information since the full fire control system has been wiped out. And in the confusion of, hey, why is the data stopped? You know, what station is going to take over? Do we start firing ourselves, etc., etc.? That could have accounted for a cessation of fire, after which, obviously, further damage compounding from hits from Rodney and King George's 5th meant fire wasn't resumed again. Another possibility would be that Barbette hit, because that is known to have caused quite a substantial amount of fire to break out around the bow area. So it's possible, much like South Dakota's gunners were during the night action of Guadalcanal alongside Admiral Lee, because there was a fire around the turrets, although not in the turrets, it meant that they couldn't see out. So if they've lost fire control directions from the forward fire control director because it's been destroyed, or communication lines have been cut to it, either way, and they're trying to use local control, but all the rangefinders, etc., can see are flames and smoke, and then subsequently, obviously, the flames and smoke have then coated the optics with soot, that would give them no data with which to continue firing until the shells that actually physically knock out Anton and Bruno turrets arrive. Or the other thing could have been that that Barbette hit, and or possibly a few other hits in the general area that are known to have caused fires, could potentially have caused some fire or flash to reach further down the system in one or either gun house and brought fire close to the magazines, which may have then resulted in the magazines automatically or manually being flooded to prevent a magazine explosion. And then, of course, without any ammunition, then, well, the turrets couldn't fire except with whatever they would have happened to have had in the turrets at the time. And, well, at that point, again, shells from King George V and Rodney were soon to directly knock out either of those turrets anyway. He then goes on to ask, you said that the hit that killed the command staff is the one that exploded up against the front face of the conning tower. So many questions here. What time did this hit occur and at what range? As it means the opposing ship would have actually been directly in front of Bismarck. And for this shell to have killed everyone on the navigation bridge for sure, but I don't think it would have killed everyone in the command bridge and the conning tower. I don't think that the captain, admiral, or his staff would have been out on the navigation bridge with no real ability to navigate the ship. So do we know where exactly the command staff was when they were killed? Well, the hit is normally attributed to have occurred at about 9:02. And at that point, Bismarck is heading, very roughly speaking, north-northwest. Meanwhile, Rodney and King George V are approaching from approximately, again, northwest. So they're almost, not quite, but almost on reciprocal courses at that stage, which would mean that, obviously, Bismarck's bow is more towards them than not. But you've also got to take into account that while obviously the British ships are trying to manoeuvre to get the best firing angles, and it, at one point obviously do pass more broadside to broadside, Bismarck is also lurching port and starboard in a somewhat crazy manner. So in the kind of 8:55 to 9:05 engagement window that we're looking at for this hit to occur, during that time, according to the track charts, Bismarck can be anywhere from near enough broadside on to King George V and Rodney to near enough bow on to King George V and Rodney and everything in between because of the way she's weaving back and forth. So the fact that the shell has hit not quite perpendicular, but near enough perpendicular on the front of the conning tower isn't exactly surprising given what Bismarck would have been doing at that point. As for would it have killed everyone in the command bridge and the conning tower, within the conning tower, almost certainly, because you've got to remember that, and this is a problem that goes all the way back to the Battle of Tsushima, and one of the reasons why the British stopped using them and later on even stopped installing conning towers of any substantial armouring on their ships, is the fact that you do not need a penetration to the conning tower to kill everybody inside it. Because just because the armor keeps the shell out, if you think about the armor or the belt armor on a battleship, you have the big slab of metal, obviously, but then you usually have some form of backing, and that can be various things, but very often it's timber. And then internal to that, you will have open space, which will usually not have anybody in it. And there will be bulkheads, and on quite a number of designs, there'll even be splinter bulkheads somewhat further in. Specifically because when a one-ton-plus armor-piercing shell comes in, even if it doesn't explode, there's a fantastic amount of kinetic energy involved. And if it does explode, there's, well, the chemical energy from the explosion in addition. And that causes spalling. And that's what the backing is there to absorb. And that's why the areas immediately behind the armor, generally speaking, don't have anyone in them while battle is going on. And why you very often have splinter bulkheads to absorb that spalling that will almost certainly occur with any kind of significant heavy hit, even if the belt itself isn't penetrated, assuming that the shell hits with any significant degree of force, which of course in this case it has. Whereas in a conning tower, if you've been inside any of the preserved conning towers on various ships, you'll see that there is no backing of any description, and there are people right on the other side of the conning tower, because it's a very small, compact area. And the whole thing is usually mostly or fully enclosed, depending on the period, but for World War II, fully enclosed. And that means that when a hit to the conning tower occurs, sure, armor-piercing shell gets kept out, massive amount of spalling come off the inside of the conning tower, that is then going to obviously shred anyone and anything in its path. And then because in a World War II period battleship, that conning tower is fully enclosed, as opposed to a Tsushima-style one where there's just an open doorway with another armor plate beyond it, that shrapnel, the spalling, is going to hit the opposite side of the conning tower, and then it's going to ricochet back. Not necessarily the back the way it came, because obviously the internal part of the conning tower is curved, but it's going to ricochet back inside and again and again and again until it loses energy. So essentially, any kind of heavy shell hit to a conning tower is going to turn the interior of that conning tower into a blender with people in it. That's going to kill basically everybody. And on top of that, you are actually going to have the shockwave, the kinetic energy shockwave coming through. So you're going to get overpressure, which probably is going to pulp a good number of people, if they're lucky, because that's probably quicker than being torn limb from limb by shrapnel. And just the sheer noise of it as well, which is going to be part of the shockwave. The whole thing's going to literally ring like a bell, because that's what it's temporarily been turned into. So, yeah, 16-inch shell slamming in at, relatively speaking, medium to short range, and digging a big crater out the front like you saw. Yeah, anyone inside, if they're lucky, is going to be killed by the transmitted shockwave. And if they're not, it's going to be a case of, well, which particular major, artery or vein are you going to bleed out from first? Plus, of course, you could also have blast infiltrate via the viewing slits, but that's probably the least of your worries. Next part, he says, is there's no mention in any survivor testimony that the center shaft was damaged. Junak was specifically stationed in the center turbine room, and the shaft was never shut down, nor does he ever mention abnormal behavior coming from the shaft. It's also stated that all of Bismarck's screws were still turning as she capsized. I would think someone would have mentioned the center screw was bouncing off the rudder and in shambles if that had been the case. In my opinion, it sounds far more likely that the parts of the stern that collapsed onto the screw while the ship was rolling, or the screw was damaged when the ship hit the bottom and slid, as Bismarck landed on a mountain and slid quite a long way before turning sideways and sliding some more to a halt. So how do we separate bottom damage from the damage caused by capsizing, floor impact, and sliding? Well, I mean, sure, it's a possibility that some damage was caused by the ship hitting and sliding, which, well, obviously, as we can see with the ripped-off portion of the bow, that did happen elsewhere on the ship. However, in terms of the center screw, the stern falling off, well, you can see in the footage, there's still quite a bit of an overhang from where the bit of the stern fell off to where the central screw is. So it's relatively unlikely that it would fall forward at that severe an angle. And even if it did, it would, if anything, contact the lower blades of the screw, not the upper blade like we see on the wreck. So the stern collapsing and then hitting it, unlikely. And similarly, when the ship hits the bottom and slides, I think there's two things there. Firstly, again, the damage we see is to the top propeller blade, and any damage caused by the slip and slide would most likely have been to the lower blades, which are buried in the sediment. And also that central screw is in a somewhat more sheltered position than the port and starboard screws. And again, we saw in the footage, the starboard screw there is essentially unaffected by exactly the same conditions. So given all of that, for there to have been a chunk taken out of the top blade on the central screw and for everything else we can see from the ship screws to be intact, it seems unlikely. Therefore, it seems more likely that this has been caused by some other means. So looking at why Zhunak didn't report anything, well, for one thing, obviously, if the rudder is blown into the screw smashes it and a chunk is taken out of the screw, the rudder is then not going to be in contact with the screw. So it's not going to be permanently in contact going bonk, 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 bonk. This would have been during the initial attack. Subsequent to that, however, it is noted in multiple survivors' accounts that as they try to regain control of Bismarck, given that the rudders are jammed, that they're trying all sorts of combinations on the three screws of, you know, port side ahead and center ahead with starboard off or starboard in reverse, sometimes various screws at half rather than full, etc., etc. And it's noted that during all of this, the hull is vibrating quite significantly, with most people putting it down to the constant changes in the speed and direction of the various propellers. Plus, of course, you have the fact the ship's being pulled left, right, and center by the combination of the wind, the waves, and the rudders being, well, at least one of them being at an off angle, the other one potentially not being there at all, at which point vibrations caused by potential damage to the propeller shaft and vibrations caused by that chunk taken out of the screw either would have been missed completely or would have just been incorporated into the wider vibration that everybody was feeling and attributing to the grander issues of trying to gain some semblance of control to the ship. And while I usually am loath to disregard first-hand survivor accounts of various battles and so forth, I generally do find Zhunak's testimony about Bismarck and her time in the final part of the battle to be a little bit suspect, not least because it's contradicted by other people who were in that same portion of the ship. So, I mean, what you've presented there is roughly speaking, a summary of the relevant portions of what Zhunak is stated to have claimed about at least his part of Bismarck's engineering section. However, other people who were also there mentioned that, for example, during the torpedo attack by the Swordfish, the floor plates, if you like, in the central engine room were buckled up in places by up to half a meter by the effects of the explosion caused by the torpedo hit aft. Yeah, that's fairly substantial. I mean, it's not shutting down the central turbine engine room, but that is a degree of damage that's occurring, which is, yeah, a little bit far off from, oh no, everything is perfect and tickety-boo. And during the final battle itself, again, we have testimony from people who were in that portion of Bismarck's machinery spaces that water was cascading down from above, and eventually the ventilators were also sucking in fumes, toxic fumes, presumably from fires and explosions above, that were forcing them to put on gas masks. Again, that's not exactly everything is fine and exactly like she was on the dock side. So, yeah. Bit of a, shall we say, difference in testimony between various people who were there, who were also there, and, oh no, absolutely everything was perfect and lovely in this area, thank you very much. And finally, both for this section of questions and for the video. Geoffrey Blake also asks, you mentioned that the secondary turret must have been hit fairly early on because of its position. All the other experts I've read suggest that the secondary battery moved due to the forces from the ship as it sank. But lastly, I really appreciated the video footage and I agree on your assessment of the bow damage. I would like it if you could perhaps redo the video and match the hits to the time that they happened to help recreate more accurately what happened in Bismarck's final battle, as well as clearing up some other misconceptions that people have carried around about the battle as a whole. So for the second part, eventually Magellan are intending to put all of their wreck footage together into one big navigatable 3D model. And when that happens, I think it's going to be a lot easier to do a video where we go, okay, at 0852, this shell hit occurred and here it is. And then at 0902, this shell hit occurred and here it is, at least for the shell hits and impact times that we know, simply because then we can look at this overall model constructed of a photo montage of all the videos footage and skip from one to the other very quickly and easily, as opposed to at the moment, while I've got access to all the footage, that's hours and hours and hours of footage. And then having to skip and slide between all those bits of video footage is much more difficult. But yeah, eventually that can be done. And of course, when it comes to clearing up various misconceptions, well, as we go through more and more of the footage on Magellan's channel, we'll be able to look at other bits of the wreckage and clear that up. In fact, we do look at the what portion of the main gun director in one of the videos that either should be out or will be upcoming soon on Magellan's channel. But again, you know, as we go through the wreck footage, we'll address that as we come across the various bits and pieces of the ship. Now, as for the secondary battery moving due to the forces from the ship as it sank, I would respectfully disagree with that assertion as a general assertion for a number of reasons. Firstly, more generally, the ship's secondary battery is pointing in all different directions. If the secondary battery was all being shifted around by the ship sinking, you would expect it to all be pointing in roughly the same direction, not even necessarily entirely the same direction, but, you know, if the forces due to the ship sinking, rotating, etc., and even hitting the seabed, dislodged the turrets and shifted them and mounts and shifted them around, you would expect them to all at least vaguely be pointing in the same direction because they're all experiencing vaguely the same force. But instead, they're pointing every which way. Another more direct fact is that when you look at that 105mm mount, port side number one mount, you can see that there's a path that one of the big shells has taken, which I've mentioned earlier in this video, which has ripped out the port side of that mounting. And you can trace that shell path through the mounting into a divot in the deck and a hole in the superstructure immediately behind it, which means at the very least that 105mm mounting has not moved since the moment it was hit. Now, the next 105mm mount's been reduced to a pile of mangled wreckage, so of course it's a bit impossible to say one way or the other whether that's moved. However, the forward port side 150mm mount, the one that's had its back, the back of it blown out, there is a bunch of shrapnel damage on the superstructure immediately around the back, well, the now missing portion of that turret, which would tend to match with the idea of, well, that's where the turret was when it all exploded. And perhaps more critically, as the drone pans around that turret, there's no major shrapnel damage anywhere else in the recess of that turret, which, you know, if it perhaps had been facing forward and it shifted to point aft during the ship sinking, you would expect the shrapnel damage from the explosion that took out its back to be somewhere else around there. But instead, the shrapnel damage to the superstructure seems to match up with pretty much where that turret is at the moment. The second 150mm turret, I mean, it's got a hole in the top that's clearly burned out the inside or blown out the inside, but there's nothing around it that says one way or the other whether, you know, whether it should be in that position or not. But given that in that forward port quarter you've got four secondary mounts or turrets, and out of the three that aren't just mangled lumps of wreckage, which the second 105 mil mount, as we said, is, the other two seem to have damage immediately around them that corresponds with the damage done to them, indicating that they at least are in the positions they were when they were knocked out, which would tend to suggest that perhaps this other one probably also is. And in separate footage, which you haven't seen in the video that I did, but is going to be shown later on Magellan's channel as we comment on it, you can actually see another one of the 150 mil mounts. And as compared to those two, obviously one of which is trained almost aft, the other one's still trained forward, this other one is trained out almost perpendicular. And there's actually a bit of fallen wreckage that's kind of wedged itself between the recess and the turret, which again would appear to indicate that is, you know, has frozen in position where it was when it was disabled. So broadly speaking, I can't see any particular evidence that the secondary battery moved position as the ship sank, and I can point to a fair bit of direct evidence that shows at least a good portion of the secondary battery that's been filmed didn't move when the ship sank. And if those didn't, I would struggle to see any real reason why the others would, given that they're not just freely rotating. They're locked in place by motors and cogs and pinions and gears, in part because that's how fire control has to work. So once all that fails and they lock into place, apart from falling out, I'm not really seeing how they move, free rotate. I mean, if we could still see 20mm and 37mm mounts, yeah, I could understand those perhaps free rotating, but not the big stuff. And that wraps up this particular special edition Q&A. Let me know if you thought that was helpful, and hope to see you again in another video soon. Bye for now.